Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Belgian Football Podcast. My name is Ben Jackson, and I'll be your host once again. And I am joined by Scott Coyne. Scott, how are you doing this evening?
I'm great, Ben. How are you? It's always good to be back this time of the week. My favourite time of the week.
Yep, 100%. The best time of the week for sure. Two-man game once again. Let's quickly go through the results from the weekend. So we had on Friday night, Oostend hosted Anderlecht. Poor Oostend, they lost again. That one finished 2-0 to the Moors. Cercle Bruges left it late to come back from behind to draw 1-0 with Standard Liège. Eupen, they got a draw as well. They drew 1-1 at home to Vesterlo. Sarang finally won a game at home in the league. First time in over a year. They beat Leuven 2-1. Sint-Truiden, they beat Kortrijk 1-0. Antwerp and Club Bruges played out a 0-0 draw. Mechelen completely threw it away and they drew 2-2 with Charleroi at home. Gent and Genk played out a bit of a thriller. That one finished 3-2 to Genk. Ellen Union absolutely dismantled Zultavagem to win 4-0 at home to round off the weekend. But let's start on the coast then, shall we? Where, yeah, Oostend absolutely desperate to get something, any sort of points. A win mainly is what they really, really need because they are really struggling. They were quite active at the deadline, bringing in a couple of players. Well, just one player actually on the deadline. I think it was Matthew Balak, the Croatian central defender. He didn't feature in this game. Neither did Fraser Hornby. I think it looked like an injury pre-match because all the talk was that he was going to play. He was on the squad list for the game as well that they released beforehand. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to start, so Ivan Derdov started instead. For Anderlecht, Islam Samani, who they brought in on deadline day, he didn't start either. He's on the bench, but he looks and said he's going to be back at full fitness sometime soon. But it wasn't any of the strikers that got the game going. It was actual Michael Murillo. It was a kind of corner for Anderlecht that really wasn't dealt well with by Oostend. Stoykins kind of heads it back across. And Murillo is basically there in the 6-yard box to roll it past Dion Phillips into the net. And it really did kind of roll into the back of the net, much to his delight. The much maligned Michael Murillo, I guess we could say about him, Scott. Because, yeah, let's just say Anderlecht fans don't mince their words when he has a poor performance. But I'm sure they'd have been happy to see that in the net. Benito Raman was probably quite happy to see it in the net. He was in the stands with the Anderlecht fans in the away end. Although, as you pointed out, Scott, while he was signing autographs, no one was holding his beer for him. So he kind of had his beer like in his mouth. Also, I think he's in trouble for jumping a fence or something at this game. I haven't really looked into it, but there. The Benito Raman kind of saga continues. Probably didn't trust anyone not to do something to his beer. Clearly he was very protective over that. But I always love seeing a player in the stands with the fans. I think it, especially with Anderlecht at the moment where there seems to be a disconnect between the club and the fans, that having a player in the stands is always a good sign. Anderlecht completely dominated the game in terms of possession, 59% to 41%, but they were definitely thankful to their young goalkeeper, Vaart Verbruggen, in this one. He made a couple of really, really important saves. But in the first half, Ivan Derdov, he really should have got off the mark. Really good ball in. I think it was from Robbie de Haas in from the right-hand side, or is it Nick Batsner? One of those guys puts the ball into the box and Derdov just completely like 50p heads it. It comes off the corner of his head basically and just flies out harmlessly wide. And yeah, he really, really should have done better. And I feel like he looks like one of those players that would have needed a goal to give him some confidence. Thierry Ambrose came on again. He wouldn't start the game, which was a bit of a surprise given his important goal against Kortrijk. But he came on and started to make a few things happen, testing for Bluggen again, who made, again, even more saves. I feel like I'm saying again quite a lot in this one. Islam Samani, he did come on. He came on in the second half. Ashimiru also came on at halftime. And I thought he actually played a really, really good game, Ashimiru. And unfortunately, he got injured and had to come back off again, which is a little bit frustrating for them. But Slimani came on and while he didn't light things up on his debut, I know a lot of people are questioning the signing and it was obviously, and you know, if you've kind of followed the transfer saga of that one, was a 10 p.m. deadline day kind of inquiry and signing, although they claim that they were always looking at him. I don't mind it as a 6-month kind of option. I think he's a clever striker. I think from what we saw, his movement's reasonably good. His link-up play as well, I think, is going to be his biggest asset for Anderlecht. And I think with the players they've got around, especially the likes of Amuzu, Andalea, who can run at players and run in behind, his kind of ability to position himself, win the ball, hold it up, pass it on, will be quite crucial. And he may not score as many as people want him to score. I mean, the man's only scored, like, I think it was 1 goal in 16 league games for Brest when he signed. But I feel like his intelligence on the pitch could really pay off. And he was involved in the decisive goal for Anderlecht. He was offside in the build-up, but it felt like, and I think there's some controversy around that, but it was quite behind when the ball kind of got into the actual danger zone for the goal. Could have scored it himself when Vasseur kind of squared it across, but he left it and Anders Dalea was there to get his first goal in Anderlecht colours. Really nice finish from him in the 89th minute to basically kill the game off. So it's a big win in a sense for Anderlecht just to keep some momentum going, keep a little bit upward momentum, I guess we could say. It's unbeaten in three now, one draw, two wins. Had to beat Oostende, really. I think given everything that's happening at the moment, they really did need this result. Oostende, on the other hand, it's frustrating because they didn't play too badly in this one. It's just that Anderlecht had the little bit of quality that Oostende are really lacking, and arguably the confidence that Oostende are really lacking.
Yeah, I think it's the small margins thing again, isn't it? That you so often see in football, all sorts of levels, you know, Anderlecht just being more incisive on the whole. I kind of agree with you, you know, circling back to Slimani, I think that's not nearly as bad a signing as some people think it actually is. I think, you know, he can fit into what they're working with there at the moment and have an impact. And it was interesting to hear him say that he hopes to stay beyond the end of the season as well. I was really impressed by Anders Dreyer this week, particularly his movement. You know, watching him a bit in this game, it's noticeable how he deliberately gives himself, you know, 2 or 3 yards wherever he is in the pitch, which allows him time to pick a pass, whether that's an assist or score. He got his goal, which was decisive in this game, you know, as you were saying. But yeah, his movement really impressed me, and I can see why he's been kind of quite successful in both, you know, decent output in terms of his own goals and assists. So I can totally understand, having seen just a very small amount of him up till now, why Jesper Vredberg was so keen to bring him in. And I think he can contribute. He looks like a very intelligent player and has been brought in obviously for very specific reasons as a kind of creative outlet and a kind of creator for them. So although there's quite a lot of pressure on him, the early signs there are reasonably encouraging that, you know, he can over the course of time bring more to this side. I was quite impressed by him. Oostende, on the other hand, I thought, like you said, they didn't actually play badly, but the thing that was most concerning for me about them was I thought they lacked the general intensity that they would want to bring. I'm not sure Dominic Thalhammer will have been particularly happy with the lack of aggressiveness in their play. You know, in terms of their duels, I thought they were quite a bit off the pace with a lot of it, and that will be a bit of a worry. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, you were talking about Fraser Hornby not being there. Oostende played rather well a couple of weeks ago against Kortrijk, very unlucky not to get all of the points in the end in a game where, you know, Fraser Hornby was obviously kind of rushed back in because of the impact he has had for them this season. And yet again, here's a game where he's out of the side and they've kind of struggled again. So although we've emphasised this a lot, it's kind of, you know, it's happening again. You know, no Hornby, you know, kind of no result for them. And they've slipped to the bottom of the table because of other results this weekend. So, you know, our sinking fast metaphor, unfortunately, is coming very true for them at the moment. And, you know, it's looking grim for them just now.
It was just kind of the worst combination of results. I think, like you're saying, you kind of, lots of teams are probably hoping that Solang were dead and buried, but they're just not. Whenever you write them off, they seem to get that win, which we will talk about, obviously. Don't want to jump too far ahead of ourselves, but it's just like a sucker punch to Oostende, because as long as they had a team below them, you kind of feel a little bit more like, oh, there's a chance. We're in touch and shoots and we're still fine. But now it's like, oh, we've got to leapfrog other teams, which they can because it is tight down there. And one other team decided just to completely punt this weekend into the long grass. And we'll definitely talk about them at the back end of this podcast. But yeah, it's hard to kind of pick up and pick apart much of Oostende at the moment because they are just so poor and lacking in confidence. And they just need a result and then to see those 3 points on the board and then push themselves forward. But they're still within touching distance. And I think that is, as long as that's there, they've still got a chance. And they've said they're going to stick with Dominic Thalhammer till the end of the season. They're not going to do another change. So it is very much on him and his shoulders to kind of turn things around and try and get the best out of those players that they have brought in. But yeah, it's just, we spoke about their transfer window business last week. I went and did another, like a gradings for Get Belgian and Dutch Football on the transfer window. And I look back at theirs again in the conversation we had, Scott, and my opinions are completely the same. It's just slightly directionless and a bit odd and a bit of players that have come in that just seem to fit to be the same as other players, but not better than those other players. We'll see what the new centre-back is like. He's got a lot to do and a lot to go. I mean, it can't get much worse than it is at the moment with their leaky defence, but now pinning all your hopes on this guy that we haven't seen play and I don't know too much about, to be fair. So I don't want to, like we said last week, don't want to Slam, a player that we don't know too much about, but he's going to have to be a hell of a player to turn things around in their back line.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult for them at the moment because they've got that situation where they want to play the same way they've been playing for a while now, particularly that kind of template that was so successful for Alexander Blessing. They've brought in Dominic Thalhammer, who plays, wants his sides to play in a very similar manner to that. So they've gone and got a coach who fits the profile and who we said when he was appointed, we thought, yeah, this is a good fit, but that's not so much the issue. I think the issue at the moment, obviously, is the players aren't responding. So either they don't like what's going on, which I my view is it's affected by a lot of the off-field things going on at the moment with the club. But it's very easy to forget the quality that has left, you know, since Alexander Blessing's left as well. And actually, they haven't been adequately replaced. The recruitment really hasn't been good enough, and the players aren't responding. So there's a doubt as to whether Dominic Thalhammer has the right quality of players to play the sort of system he wants to play and the demands that places on you, you know, because you have to be really fit to play that sort of game. And sometimes it looks like they're kind of struggling with that. So it's not a great recipe for the Coos boys at the moment.
No, they could definitely do with getting Cameron McGeehan back in there to give them a little bit more energy. Let's go to Bruges now, Dominic Thalhammer's former team, Cercle Bruges, obviously under Miro Muzlic now. And I mean, they just love these kind of late on game impact goals, don't they? A tight game between two pretty decent teams at the moment, Standard and Cercle Bruges, both kind of fighting in that playoff too. Cercle obviously wanted to break in, Standard wanted to keep their place, and with some of the results this weekend, potentially actually push into playoff one. It's still a possibility, as much as we don't think it's likely. They've probably thought they'd won it in the 81st minute when they were awarded a penalty, upsets Philip Zinkernagel, and he makes it 1-0 to Standard. They've just got to hold out, but 10 minutes later, we should probably start calling Cercle the throw-in specialist, because it's clearly, we've spoken about before, it is something they work on, it's something they do, and that man, Yasser Iweda, with his 10th league goal of the season. And someone said it actually on social media, I think it was, that the way he hits the ball is so clean. It's just like this swivel volley. And we've seen it before. Like, we saw it in the flesh when we saw him playing in that game against Charleroi. Mm. He does hit the ball really, really cleanly. His like shooting technique that you kind of get trained in as a kid, like laces and all that, like, he's got it down to perfection. Mm. So he gets the equaliser in the 91st minute, which means I think it's now three games in a row that Cercle have either won the game or rescued a point late on, beat Oostend late on, beat Ghent late on, obviously with that Jesper Darland goal, and then this one with the Wade. And I think if you're Ronnie Dyler, you're frustrated because you see your side get that goal, go 1-0 up. You're probably thinking, right, yeah, we've got the 3 points here if we hold on, which would have put them above Ghent after the weekend's results and a point behind Club Bruges. Whereas if you're Cercle Bruges, you're just like, this is now becoming part of our identity where we don't give up. And it's seeing them with the set pieces, with the throw-ins and stuff. And I'm sure tactical analysis guys out there, your kind of tactics nerds, will have papers and things ready to be written about how Cercle Bruges are using throw-ins. And if you're thinking about doing it, please do get on and do it, because it'd be such an interesting read, because it's so clearly part of their game plan. But I've also seen after this game a lot of praise for Hugo Sique, people saying he looks like he's come back a much better player from his kind of time in Freiburg, where he didn't get to play as much as he probably would have liked, but he's developed and stuff. So yeah, good to see Hugo kind of get back into it. Yeah, for Standard, at least I guess seeing Philip Zinkernagel score again is great to see in terms of getting goals from him, because he is their main goal scorer at the moment. But frustrating that they couldn't really hold on to what would have been a really, really crucial extra 2 points, I guess.
Yeah, you're dead right. This was a really close game, a really interesting game kind of tactically as well. And I think Standard are actually starting to become more consistent, in the sense that recipe that Ronnie Dyle has been searching for and kind of trying to embed into this squad about, look, we might not have as much of the ball as we would like in games because we don't really have those sorts of players in the team at the moment. What's important to us is that we do use the ball in the right ways, particularly when we get into, for example, the final third, and they're certainly becoming more consistent at that. There's a number of points in this game actually where they did nearly score through, you know, the right pass at the right moment and being incisive and actually kind of quite clever with their choices. So that's very encouraging from their point of view. And yeah, it did look like they perhaps what would have been a very good win, actually, against a very good Circle side at the moment, who are, you know, continually impressing with their consistency for the most part and their physical ability to kind of dominate sides. They play very good, effective football, Circle. I think they've got a great recipe going on at the moment. You mentioned Hugo Sique. I thought he had a really decent game. I had a feeling before this game that he would have a good day playing against, obviously, one of his old sides, you know, several points to kind of prove. It was nice to see him picking up some of his former teammates off the ground as well after fouling them. There was a warmth there and a competitive edge, which was quite nice to see. And yeah, an enjoyable game, this one. Aouida's goal, just sensational. You know, you were talking about the technique with it. And, you know, when I was watching the game live, it actually got me up out of my seat. Just, it was that good a hit. And I really like the way he buys himself a couple of yards from the throw-in. You know, he steps forward, chests it down. That gives him a couple of yards. And then he absolutely hammers it on the turn. And most impressive is he actually, if you've seen it goes in at the near post. Normally when a player tries that, they'll shoot across the goalkeeper, but you know, he's instinctively hit it really, really cleanly, as you were saying. And technically, it's just a brilliant goal, giving Bodar absolutely no chance. Nice reaction from Miron Muzlic as well when that goal went in. Cool and controlled celebration, which I thought was nice to see. There's a lot of joy on the Circle bench, and they've had some really late goals to celebrate recently, which are always a little bit sweeter, no matter what the result, I suppose, because of how unexpected they are. And to be honest, I didn't see that coming. That's the sort of thing that will be hugely encouraging for everybody at Circle, to know that you have a player like Yazzie Aouida who, out of nothing, which is really what that was, can kind of do that. I would be on the throw-in point, I'd be really interested to learn more from the team at Circle as to whether that particular move is something that has been practiced in training, because it did have the look of something that definitely had been worked on because of its crispness as well. But yeah, absolutely sensational stuff.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's good to see. Whenever Wader scores, I feel like they were quite nice goals. Two good teams, a good game, just kind of good advert for Belgian football, I guess we could say. But let's move on to, I think I saw someone I follow on Twitter was at this game, Eupen against Vesselo, and their reaction was, there's a reason Eupen are in a relegation battle. This is coming from, yeah. Someone that just came, turned up and watched the game. Vesselo had a lot of chances. 15 shots, just 6 on target. They had all the possession, 57% possession. They only made the breakthrough just before half-time. That meant Nene Dorgelis getting on the score sheet. However, just about 20-odd minutes after half-time, Eupen were back at level. They get awarded a penalty. Up steps Steph Peters in the 68th minute to make it 1-1. A few notes of interest in this. Eupen were pretty active, actually, at deadline day. Loic Basseri came in from Charleroi, which I think looks like a good pickup. They also signed the former Kimki centre-back, who I think his contract ran out in January, so they just picked him up on a free. Alexander Filin, Loic Basseri. And then they signed a Spanish guy from Wisła Płock. I'm not laughing because of the signing. I think he actually looks like a really good signing. He was their top scorer this season so far. But his name's Davo. But in my English way, I just read it as Davo. Very kind of like Sunday League nickname for a Spanish flair winger. As you'd probably, you don't really think of a Davo as a Spanish flair winger. But yeah, they bring in Davo, or David Alvarez as his actual name is, which sounds a little bit more fun than Davo. he comes in. And yeah, he looks like, on paper, looks like he should be a really good signing from Wisła Płock. I think he scored 10 goals for them so far this season. Grabbed in, came with a couple of assists as well. He was a deadline day signing. But like Vaseli, I think he's a good signing for them in terms of just getting a bit more experience on the back. We'll see what this other guy coming in from Russia's like. But I don't know, Scott, kind of talking about this one, Eupen's kind of lineup was very much, it looked a little bit defensive because Prevoyak was on the bench, which seems a bit weird when they're at home. Prevoyak obviously came on in the second half, but poor Ed still looking for that win. At least they didn't lose, I guess, but
for Vesta, they'll probably be a little bit frustrated that they weren't actually able to really kind of take advantage of all the possession and chances they had.
Yeah, well, I remember us when we were talking about Open last week, Ben, we were talking about how important it was that they just started to pick up some points somehow, because things were starting to look a bit squeaky bummy, should we say, for them. You know, and since then, obviously, you know, Steph Peters, since coming back from injury, has now got 2-2. So that quality back in the side is starting to tell a little bit, albeit they were both penalties, but, you know, they still count. And, you know, a bit of a battling performance in an uninspiring way, you know, to dig out a point. And it's things like that that they're going to need to do more of for the next few weeks, just to kind of keep their noses where they would want to be, because there's not that much room for error, obviously. I think Ed Stibb will be encouraged by the new faces that have come in. I think he's quite pleased with those, from what I can tell, and I think he's feeling a little bit better now that the window's closed and that some faces have come in as well. He's shuffling the side around a little bit, like you were saying. It was a bit of a defensive setup, which is a little bit odd for a home game, I suppose. But when you look at how good Westerlo have been, you know, offensively throughout the season up till now, I can kind of understand that, especially with, you know, the home side being a bit low on confidence as well. I'm sure Ed's thinking was, look, you know, try and just stay in the game, because actually this is going to be a game where the visiting side are going to have more of the ball than us, and they did. They had a fair bit more possession, so I'm sure it was based on that more than anything else. So his tactics probably were right for this particular game. They've picked up a point, and it's an important point, you know what I mean, which kind of keeps them on track. And they've got some fixtures coming up, you know, which are winnable or have points in for them. So they'll be feeling a little bit better this weekend. Westerlo won't be too disheartened by that, I don't think. They've dropped off a little bit recently, I think, but still managing to pick up points themselves. So yeah, interesting game this. Interesting.
Yeah, it's just they're still, like we said, yeah, they needed to pick up points and stuff like that, but it's then, I think, six without a win now. And they're not coming much easier at the moment, any easier going forward. Obviously, Mechelen's a big one, who they're just behind at the moment. Mm. There's Antwerp, Cercle, Union, before they face Oostend in March, which is going to be a big one. You just know it's going to be a big one. And then they don't have too many other winnable games on paper. They got Ghent, Anderlecht, but they are playing like just before they're kind of the end of the regular season, as we call it. They do face Kortrijk and Zoltava again. So those games, you feel like it's going to come down to those at some point. I think we're just going to have to kind of temper ourselves a little bit before writing any of these sides off until it's mathematically done, because anything could happen, which is a nice segue into Sarang finally winning at home. The fans of the Metallos, they can finally celebrate a win, and fair flipping play to them turning up for a year at home in the league and not seeing any victories. They definitely deserved to see something good. We'll speak about the ramifications for Leuven, because it does need to be spoken about, this defeat. It's not in isolation at the moment. But Sarang took the lead through Morgan Poati. He got a goal in the 4th minute to give them a really, really quick start in this one, which I think kind of says that it gives them that little bit momentum going into the game, starting quickly, getting that first goal at home, being like, right, we're not losing again. We're not drawing again. We're going to get the win here. But then a set piece undid them in the 37th minute. Federico Rica with a lovely header that Deitch had absolutely no chance in. Leuven did have 19 shots in this game, but only 5 on target, which is just not great. Whereas for Lang, we saw the return of Marius Mirandel Maggi. Good to see him back. He had a really, really kind of good first half of the season, despite their struggles, and it's nice to see him back. He wasn't the one that got the winning goal, though. It was Christophe Lapointe. Who would have thought? The Mouscron man. The man that didn't think he would ever play 1A again. 85th minute, he gets the winner. I think they've even invited him on some of the talk shows this week. Like, that's how big a moment this was. Great atmosphere in terms of seeing that ball go into the back of the net from the fan case. They come off the bottom of the table, which is mental when you think they literally haven't won any games for months now, which kind of shows how bad the teams around have been doing, and those teams at the bottom of the league have been doing. And the league's probably looking at that and saying, yeah, this is why we're getting rid of 3 teams and only allowing 1 to come up, because these teams at the bottom just are not putting the standard that we want. But a great win for Sarang. I'd written them off. I feel like I've still written them off in that sense. But they're going to fight, and that's all they can really do. For Leuven now, I think you mentioned, Scott, in our chat, it's 1-7. Mm. I've made it just 2-13, which is really, really, really poor. They've dropped out of playoff 2. They're now 4 points outside of playoff two. Those wins, incidentally, have been against Selang when they beat them 5-0. And that was also the 2-1 win away at Vestalo a couple of weeks ago, where Mario Gonzalez scored two in the space of 5 minutes, which they almost did throw away, actually. They could have thrown that one away as well. They're just trending in a really, really bad way and a really bad direction. And they're only, I say only, but like they're 11 points off the bottom. But with the way they're playing, they may be like just surviving on the basis that they've got enough points already. But the way that they're playing and trending is really concerning. And I think it's one of those things that I don't want to start being like, they're going to go down, they're going to get relegated, anything stupid like that. But it's like, keep an eye on it, if you know what I mean. It's one of those things we should be keeping an eye on over the next couple of weeks to see, are they going to turn around? Like, I trust Mark Beers to be the sort of manager that could do that. But their kind of window we spoke about, Mandela Keita obviously left as well during the window. Mark Beers was also moaning about, well, he wasn't moaning, he was like, oh, it's a shame we've lost Mandela Keita and Rafael Holzhauser, they gave me good options. I was like, you barely played Rafael Holzhauser and you didn't actually play Mandela Keita that much. Which is one of the reasons why Mandela Keita left, because he wanted more game time and he was frustrated with how things were going. So I was like, maybe if you'd played then they'd still be there. So you kind of can't have it both ways, but he's like, I understand why the club did it. But they recorded a loss as well, so it's a situation that it may not bear fruit this season, but next season, we predicted them this season to be in trouble and they started really well and proved us wrong. But next season again, they're going to be one of those teams I feel like we're going to be saying they look like they're in trouble right up until the deadline.
There's an interesting summer ahead at that club, I think, to see what they do with their recruitment, because their recruitment's been strange for a while now and we thought they'd sorted it out and it's all got rather weird again, I think it's the only way to kind of describe it. And the drop off is quite amazing, you know, in form. Actually, I think they will be okay. I don't have that many worries about that. I think they'll pick up, enough points for the end of the season to not get sucked into anything. So I feel quite strongly that won't happen. But the drop off is alarming, and I think there probably is a little bit of pressure on Mark Bryce now. I don't think they'll do anything silly before the end of the season, but I think with the way the form's been for a while, I think that puts more pressure on him than any of us had kind of expected for a coach who's actually done very well there on the whole. So it's one of those situations where it's probably not fair on him, perhaps, for him to be under a bit of pressure, but it's, you know, someone has to kind of carry the can for that often, and it's always going to be kind of the coach. So it's an odd one, that, and some kind of odd recruitment things, as I was saying, have gone on there as well that have baffled me and continue to baffle me. And like you're saying, to come out and to talk about Keita this week in kind of strange terms like that is a bit odd, because, you know, he wasn't getting any game time, as you say. So that tells me what Mark Bryce was said, that, you know, I mean, there are some unhappy faces perhaps inside the camp there for different reasons, and that might have something to do with their poor form over the last couple of months or so.
Yeah, no, that would make sense, wouldn't it? Just a strange situation there, because I've probably said it on this podcast before and people are probably sick of hearing it, but I've always seen him as a club and a team that should be pushing playoff two. Like, it feels like they've always got the infrastructure in terms of the stadium. They've had some players that they should be able to do it since coming up. But obviously the first season coming up, didn't expect them to be doing that. They just had a pretty solid season, but I just feel like they look like a club that should be able to do that. And it's frustrating seeing them drop off like this when I feel like there's quality there, but there's recruitment, like you said, it doesn't always match up and it's all a bit weird. Also forgot to mention, we mentioned Marishmund and or Maggi being back, but Gerald Colota was also back, which is great to see. I'm a big fan of Colota and he's been out for flipping ages. He had not played at all this season, but he was on the bench for Selang. So maybe Colota's going to come back and rescue their season. They're going to stay up. And honestly, if that team stays up, it's the most ridiculous thing I think that would ever happen, and would need a lot more attention outside of Belgian football, because that would just be mental.
It would be mental. I think, you know, and it's something we'll talk a lot about more if it happens, but much stranger things have happened in Belgian football, as we know. And I don't know. I mean, like you, I think the odds are that they're still toast according to the odds. But this is a side that has defied the odds on a few occasions so far. So there's plenty of evidence to the contrary to say that they've got a chance, and they absolutely do. That's what I mean. With Oostend slipping to the bottom, it's all changed again. And the bottom of the Pro League at the moment, actually, I think when you look at the leagues across Europe, is definitely worth keeping your eye on. And those who watch it regularly won't be surprised to hear us say that. But if you don't watch much Pro League action and you're listening to us, then keep an eye on the bottom, because it's really interesting and really exciting. And Sarang are a good example of almost what you can do by sticking together and hanging in there. And clearly they haven't given up. And I think, you know, on the subject of, you know, getting that first home win in a year, it's going to be really interesting to see how that impacts them now, because they were absolutely loving that, kind of, you know, rightly so, and it's such a huge thing for them. And I just wonder psychologically what that might do for them.
Yeah, no, it will be really interesting. Will it suddenly become a fortress? I don't think so, but you never know. Yeah, I think we, apart from the Bundesliga 2, which is having the most ridiculous relegation kind of scrap ever, we have got a good one here. And it was also kind of the sense that these teams were kind of playing each other over the next couple of weeks, and because everyone's kind of still got something to play for. There's that pressure on every game, which I guess is what the playoffs do kind of do, in the sense that even teams that are mid-table, they've still got a chance of playoff two or getting relegated at the moment. So definitely. And I'd thought they'd given up with their January transfer window, to be honest, when they signed, was it just Ocatio from Standard Liège, I think it was. But yeah, they only made one signing and then saw like a gazillion summer signings just leave the club, basically. But yeah, John Nacadio. Yes, it was John Nacadio from Standard EA. So I felt that maybe they weren't like building for next season, and they weren't really trying to stay in this season. They just were kind of doing, just leaving things and just seeing what happens, which, to be fair, it's not always the worst kind of approach to these things when you don't want to chuck money at it pointlessly. Let's go to the final game of the Saturday slate, which saw St. Truiden host Kortrijk, and which saw Kortrijk have all of the ball, basically 61% possession, but they didn't win. St. Truiden won this one after Abubakar Keita fell over in the box, I guess we can say. Kortrijk fans, the Kortrijk players were all around him being like, you dived. The referee was like, he dived, is about to book him. And Keita's just kind of lying there, like, he's not really saying anything. He's just literally just lying down on the artificial turf, just kind of like spaced out. Because to be fair to him, he flew into the box. And it's one of those ones where it's like, he anticipates the contact, which is what it looks like initially. And it is technically diving and it shouldn't happen, but it just feels like at the speed he's going at, you would anticipate that to kind of protect yourself in a way, like not condoning diving or anything. But I think if it's understandable that this is what happens, and if he gets booked for it, that's fine. Like, it's kind of, it's in the rules, and everyone should just be like, yeah, okay. It did look like the tackle was going to come in, because it was flipping close. And we watched on VAR and there was a touch, very, very minimal, but there was a touch. So the referee has to overturn it, which I always think is hilarious, because the Kortrijk players have surrounded Keita and like shouted at him, and they've got the decision. And then like a couple of minutes later, the decision's been completely overturned, and they look like idiots because they've called this guy a diver when VAR's intervened and said he hasn't dived. They're still fuming though. Absolutely fuming about it. Bruno steps up to take the penalty, hits the bar, hits poor Tom Vandenberg on the back of the head and goes in. He gets the own goal. Kortrijk did have chances, especially in the first half. Christophe Dehaan was back, which was good to see, actually, after everything that's kind of happened to him. Whipped in a ridiculously good ball. Probably one of the best crosses I've seen this weekend. Pap Habib Gay, who I think maybe completely misquoting here, was talking about replacing Onuachu and being like the next big striker in the Pro League, headed it over the bar. And I was kind of like, Onuachu might have scored that. Maybe just didn't say anything until you started banging the goals in. Then in the second half, Rocco Reitz had a couple of chances. Actually, I forgot to say, Daniel Schmidt made a really, really good save in the first half. I think it was from Selemani or Kadri. Looked like it was going top bins, but he just tipped it over the bar. He's had another solid season for Daniel Schmidt. But yeah, Rocco Reitz should have scored. They had a couple of other chances to kind of kill the game off. They saw Mori Konate come back, which is a big plus in the central midfield area. Still no Tony Leisner yet. We're still waiting for him to come back. But kind of a typical St. Truiden win, in the sense it's 1-0, it's at home. They go ahead and you're going to struggle to score past them. That's what, 25 goals scored, 25 goals conceded this season. Just nice solid fat zero in goal difference. For Kortrijk, I think I make it now that's just one win in their past five games. And if you look at some of those past five games, they've been against some teams they probably would have liked to beat, in sense of Mechelen and Oostende. Which could be quite costly by the end. So I don't know, I kind of wrote a thing about, is the honeymoon period over at Kortrijk? Because I don't know, I watched that East End game and I was concerned with their performance against East End. This one, they had a lot of the ball, but they couldn't score, which is again concerning if you're a Kortrijk fan, because they were having problems scoring. They've only scored one more goal than a Centurion side, who don't score many. One more goal than Oostende and three more goals than Serang. So scoring goals has been an issue, and having all that ball not scoring, even though Bernstorck was like he really wanted to get a number six in, it is a bit concerning. But again, can't be like they're completely down and trodden and going down. But worrying. I'm still.
I think the new manager bounce, I think, is kind of worn off now. You know, I mean, we've been quite positive about them in recent weeks, because Bernstorck has kind of changed the mindset in there. You know, you can see that in the way that they play. Having said that, 1-5, you know, they're not picking up the points that they were when he first went in there, and seem to have a really positive immediate impact. So that's kind of hit the buffers a bit, which is interesting. St Truiden, just as an aside issue here, St Truiden are the club this week that provided me with my favourite moment of the week. Now, those of who like to follow what's going on across the Pro League might not know this, but this week the owners, the Japanese owners at St Truiden, came out and confirmed to the world that Steyn, which is the home stadium of St Truiden, has been renamed. They've done a sponsorship deal with Daiyo, who are one of the world's biggest manufacturers of, wait for it everybody, wasabi. So Steyn is now going to be known as the Daiyo Wasabi Steyn Stadium. Now, I'm not sure that the club's Japanese owners could have injected more comedy if they'd tried with that this week. And I have to say, when I first heard this news, I actually thought it was a wind-up. I didn't think it was genuine until I checked. And sure enough, it absolutely is genuine. And just to reassure St Truiden fans, they did happen to make rather large play of the fact that, you know, Barcelona had renamed the new camp the Spotify Stadium, didn't they? As if, you know, this is nothing untoward, nothing to see here, people. But yeah, the Wasabi Steyn with Japanese owners is probably up there for me with the best stadium renaming gigs that, you know, ever. And I was thinking about this. Are there other opportunities here? I mean, are we ever going to see the Guden Carolus Achter de Kazern or the De Koninck Bosselstadion, something like that? So if you can think of any other suitable stadium sponsorship names and partnerships for clubs to enter into, do get in touch with us and let us know. And if you can top the Wasabi Steyn Stadium, which is real and not a wind-up, then you know, fair play to you.
Yeah. I think it was on the Het Belang van Limburg paper website. One of their reporters just said, "What is this bullshit?" And that was just the title of the article. And I was like, that is unreal. And then they were interviewing some fans outside the stadium, and they were like, what? Like, why is this happening? And then the new camp bit did crack me up the most, actually, because it was like, look, if it's good enough for Barcelona, it's good enough for the Steyn. It's like, no one's calling it the Spotify New Camp. And yeah, to be fair, I don't think anyone's going to call it the Wasabi whatever Steyn, are they? I think we're sticking with the Steyn.
I want to know if they're going to be handing out wasabi samples with, like, sushi at home games now. It wouldn't surprise me if you get that in corporate hospitality, but I think they might be missing a trick, particularly now they've entered in an official sponsorship deal with Daiyo Wasabi. I would be expecting that. I would wasabi crisps, wasabi-based Japanese beers, all sorts of stuff, please. So when we come calling for a visit, roll out the wasabi.
Yeah, maybe you can sit in that hotel in the corner. That's right. Have a room there and just sit and eat some wasabi, watching the game.
Pop the wasabi peanuts, which I'm quite partial to, by the way.
Nothing wrong with a bit of wasabi on this podcast, but maybe not in the front of a stadium name. that was pretty comical. And I didn't see this game in full, so I don't know if the fans did any protests, but they're probably just as dumbfounded as the rest of us, didn't have time to organise. but yeah, we'll keep an eye on how it happens in that one. But yeah, they solidify their place. Well, not solidify, they just stay in playoff two, the bottom of playoff two at the moment. Do St Truiden, whereas Kortrijk are just 2 points off the bottom. Let's go to the Sunday games. Antwerp against Club Brugge. I was out, so managed to miss this one, but I was like, you know what, go on the 11 Sport, the Pro League app, sorry, I'll go on the Pro League app and I'll watch the highlights to see what I missed. And apparently all I missed was some yellow cards, because apparently absolutely nothing happened in this game. According to the highlights that I watched, it was just a lot of yellow cards for the usual suspects, I guess we can say. Dalat got one, Lang got one, Buchanan got one, Onyedika got one, Odoi got one, Mekola got one. So a lot of Club Brugge players got one. Unfortunately, Muya picked up an injury and he's going to be out for a couple of weeks, which is a shame. He had a kind of a chance that Mignolet saved. Janssen had a chance as well. A result that doesn't really help either team. Jack Hendry was back in for Club Brugge. They obviously kept a clean sheet as well, which defensively, they're doing pretty solidly at the moment. It's just at the other end, it's the scoring goals, which looked a little bit more hard to come by in these past couple of games. I think they've only scored more than one goal twice, and that was against Zultavar again, which you'd expect, and then against Charleroi, where they had to come back from two down. But it's not the attacking, flair, controlling, dominating football that we were promised. For Antwerp, they're struggling to score as well, because they haven't scored for three games, I think it is now. So, even game, but wasn't the table-topping clash that we would have wanted to see on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, I think all that was missing really was goals. I mean, there was plenty of drama and needle in the game, and a lot of people putting themselves about, as you would, you know, as you would expect. Hence the number of yellow cards, most of which were deserved, actually. So, you know, I don't think the referee had a bad game, really, in that sense. I think my takeaway from this game was just a general lack of quality from both sides. That's what was missing, really. You know, there was a lot of huffing and puffing and players putting themselves about and being very competitive, but a real lack of quality when it came to kind of creating chances. And they did, you know, just cancel each other out from a tactical perspective as well. It was kind of quite tight like that. I think from club's perspective, I mean, what's that, one win in six since Scotty Parker came in, which isn't very good, to be blunt about it. I mean, he's obviously still finding his feet in Belgian football and tweaking that side a little bit. Interesting to see Jack Hendry coming back in and Brandon Mekola. That was quite intriguing, I thought. The big takeaway from the selection, though, was no start for Roman Yaremchuk. We know he's been barely a shadow, if I can describe it even that, of the player that we know that he can be, and he is a quality striker. You know, he's got the gear, but things just haven't happened for him since he's come to club. And it's kind of interesting with Ukla being out injured. You thought, okay, he's maybe going to get a little run here, and obviously he started last week, and you know, it didn't really happen for him. And I was thinking when I saw that he wasn't starting, I thought, right, well, that surely, if I'm Roman Yaremchuk, I'm on the phone to my agent saying, get me out of here in the summer on a loan. I just need to be playing football to get my confidence back and score some goals and, you know, become something like the Roman Yaremchuk that, you know, we all know, because he's a very good player and you know, the situation he's in can't persist for much longer, I don't think. And I suspect that the coaching staff at club don't have a great deal of confidence that he's going to be able to turn that around, kind of not at the moment. And I know they were looking for a striker before the window closed and weren't able to bring anybody in, and that, I think, isn't going to change in the summer. So I think they'll be looking at bringing somebody in the summer, which again leaves him in a slightly sticky position as well. So even a new manager coming in hasn't really changed that much from his perspective. So I don't know whether there's some issues off the pitch influencing that or not, but it isn't happening for him. And that was one of my big takeaways from this game, other than it being a very good result for Union, Genk, and probably Ghent as well. They were probably licking their lips when they saw that result before their own game later on.
Yeah, those, especially Genk and Union, were definitely the winners. And ironically, there's the two teams these two sides face next. And Club Brugge, they've done well against Union in the past, haven't they? Since they came up, especially last year and this year. So that one's going to be really interesting, because so far they've held kind of almost the psychological edge against them, in terms of they just don't seem to lose to them. But we were at that game, the reverse fixture, obviously, this season, which was finished in a draw thanks to Bart Nieuwkeep, and a 10-man Union team kind of outplayed Club Brugge, especially in the second half there. So that's, I was kind of said to you guys, this is, for me, this was Scotty Parker's biggest test so far. I think the Genk game was far too early to judge him, and the other ones that's been finding his feet. They didn't lose, so he passed it in that sense. But then next week's the next big, big test, because you're now playing a team that can score, they're confident, they're flying. They're doing what Club Brugge fans want Club Brugge to be doing, which is dominating games. And if they're not dominating games, they're still finding ways to win the games, be effective, be efficient, play with passion. All that sort of stuff is what the Club Brugge fans want. So it's going to be really interesting, that contrast. And then Antwerp are going to Genk without having scored for three games, and they'll be like, we're just desperate to score. And then it's ironic, isn't it? Obviously, Vincent Janssen been suspended, now he's back. But if he goes on a goal drought, they're then looking at that, the Michael Frey kind of departure, with a little bit more kind of like, ah, okay, yeah, that's now going to harm us a lot more than we hoped it did or would, unless Giuliano Kirk can start scoring. But he had one chance where he should have laid it off to Valencia, but he decided to balloon it into the stand behind the goal instead.
Giuliano Kirk's an interesting one, because he got into a couple of good positions. There's two or three points in this game where it's just the wrong pass, actually, the wrong choice, I thought. And it's funny, you know, you're talking about Michael Frey, actually. The one thing about Michael Frey is often his choices were very, very good, because he's such a direct player as well, and didn't tend to overthink it. You know what I mean? He never overcomplicated things, I think, Michael Frey, and it was one of his real strengths. And I remember when we were at the Bossel in October, and it was great to see him actually up close. And I came away much more impressed from seeing him and watching him a bit off the ball than I'd seen before, and was left with a much higher impression. I mean, I always thought Michael Frey was slightly overrated as a player. I never quite understood it. I thought, you know, he's just in a good run of form, but actually seeing his work off the ball, his movement and what he contributed to that side was massively impressive to me. So I think he definitely will be a loss. And yeah, Kirk just needs to improve his decision making, I thought, because I think if he'd done that in this game, actually he could have got a couple quite easily this weekend, because he does get into good positions. So he's not a bad pickup for them, and not a bad pickup in light of some of the players that they were interested in who they missed out on, one of whom has gone to one of their title challenge rivals and has started very well.
Yeah, we'll get to him in a bit as well. And yeah, no, for Kirk, I think it's just getting back to some sort of resemblance of full fitness. He was at, was it Lokomotiv Moscow, I think he was at. So obviously with their break and stuff like that, I can't imagine he played much football before coming back over to Belgium, to this part of the world. Obviously he used to play in the Netherlands and stuff. So it'll be interesting to see, as he gets kind of up and running, how he can help them. Because yeah, we spoke about it last week. He gives them a different profile of striker, and that should be quite good. Let's go to Mechelen. They were desperate to sign a striker. They were linked with Sadar Dursan, who unsurprisingly didn't come. He decided to stay where he was. This meant they're kind of going with what they've got. Although they did have Enoch Aguiar, the former Anderlecht youth player, who then went to Burnley, who then went to Mechelen on loan. They had him on the bench in this one, but it was the usual suspects back in. We spoke about this last week, Scott, how they needed them to step up. Nicolas Sorn decided to step up in the fifth minute to give them the lead. Jeffrey Hermans then in the 27th minute made it 2-0 to Mechelen. They're looking good. They're starting to kind of look a bit more confident. And then Rob Skoos does something so idiotic that it's just, you beggar's belief. Even Stephen Defoe was like, I just don't understand why you do this. And if Stephen Defoe's questioning idiocy on the pitch, then it's idiotic. Do you know what I mean? 40th minute, Charleroi are going to counterattack, but they're in their own half. So there's a chance that nothing's going to come from it. You're 2-0 up. And he just flies into the tackle, just absolutely flies in, doesn't get anywhere near the ball. The ball's already gone. It's a definite red card. I don't see what anyone can complain about. Just pure stupidity in the 40th minute. And it's punished in the second half, obviously. Adam Zorgan, two goals in the space of 2 minutes to give Charleroi a draw, basically, when they probably could have then felt about going on to win it, because these were 66 and 67th minute. But for those two goals, they then have like 17 shots, only 8 of which were on target. Bayo, obviously back in the side, given the number 9 straight up front. Nikola Stulic came on as well, so they were chucking players on. They also got Azumafor back as well, which is quite nice to see. I was a big fan of Valentin Azumafor. He came back, but unfortunately no return debut goal, I guess we could say, for Bayo. But Zorgan getting the goals, even said after the game, he was like, I think I don't care, as long as someone gets the goals and anyone can get the goals, and that's all that matters. So I guess, Scott, for this one, it's another case of frustration for both sides, because they both will look at that game and thought they should have won it at different stages.
Yeah, well, we've been talking quite a lot about the issues at Mechelen kind of recently, and this result is an absolute kind of case in point. You know, it's a bit like Groundhog Day, really. We've been talking about how important it is that the big players, you know, the Nicholas Storms, the Jeffrey Harrimans, the Rob Skoos, the Kieran Marabtis, turn up the dial on the quality, which we know that they've got, in order to get them on a little run, because they've been so inconsistent. And what happens here is, you know, Storms and Harriman, you know, bring the quality. They're in complete control of the game. And then another player who has loads of quality, who's part of that group, Rob Skuse, does something, as you were saying, really, really idiotic. And the game actually turns on that. I know it's a cliche in football that red cards often change games, and absolutely they did here. You know what I mean? It kind of changed the cliches here aside. The pendulum swung. I'm choosing deliberately to use one there. Adam Zorgan actually had a really good game, I thought. Even goals aside, I thought he was excellent. Single-handedly kind of got them back into this, really. And like you say, I think if the game had another 10, 15 minutes in it, I think Charleroi probably would have won it. Mechelen kind of, you know, just digging in for a point in the end. And hugely frustrating for Stephen Defoe, particularly when you're searching for the consistency I was just talking about, and to be in such control of a game and having put in a really decent performance up to then, to just for it to turn on one player's decision-making just being wild, will be really frustrating. And when you watch it, you see the amount of cover he's still got as well. It's just a tackle he doesn't need to make. I understand him, obviously, he wants to break up the counter-attack, but, you know, even if he misses the tackle, then there's still plenty of cover there. There's three or four other options as well. It's just, it's crazy thinking from a player who should know better, and I'm sure he was told that afterwards as well.
Yeah, I can't imagine Defoe mince his words in that one, because, excuse me, no, he'll know that he's basically cost aside the game. Obviously, Charleroi could have come back anyway, but you put the two together, don't you, really? Red card, and then they go into the second half and get the two back. So they'll probably be, in a way, I said they'll both be frustrated, but in a way, Mechelen, if you just based it in the 90 minutes, I'd have been happy that they actually got there and got the draw. Whereas for Charleroi, yeah, it'd be frustrating because it would have got them a little bit closer to that playoff two place that they probably are looking at now. They can kind of start to look a little bit up, not too far, but they can definitely start to look above them rather than below them just a little bit.
Obviously, that 0-0 draw between Club Brugge and Antwerp, as we spoke about, gave Genk a really nice chance to extend their lead, but also gave Gent a nice chance to get themselves into playoff one, and it was they who struck first in this one. Hugo Kuiper's finding Hyun-Suk Hyung in the box. 9 minutes in, he puts it in to make it 1-0, but Genk reply, a long ball over the top from the left back, well, not over the top, kind of like a long cross into the box, finds Joseph Pencil. He does really well to kind of fake it onto Nardi, who doesn't really know what to do. Goes around Nardi, tucks it into the corner of the box. His 10th goal of the season. He's hitting double digits. Still an absolute travesty. He wasn't taken to the World Cup by Ghana. Just a crazy, crazy decision there. Into the second half we go. I thought Gent finished the first half the better side. They were pushing more. They were creating more of the chances. And he felt that it just really needed to take one of those chances if they were going to come away with the win in this one. Because I always felt that if they got into halftime at 1-1, Vranken would change some things up to get the side playing a little bit more to his liking, because they weren't really playing his more favoured style of play. But Gent, yeah, finished the game with like 20 shots, only 6 on target, which kind of says their lack of efficiency in this one. In the second half, Vranken chucks on new signing Tolu Arakadare, the man that's in there to replace Paul Onuachu. He definitely looks like a lively customer for sure. Really like his energy that he brought to the game. Other January signing also comes on in year Saw, and it's actually Saw who makes the breakthrough. That man, Mike Tressel, with the cross in from the left-hand side, and Saw's header is just an absolute bullet. He just flies on to meet that ball, smashes it past Nardi. Nardi's got absolutely no chance. That's 2-1 to Genk. Genk then start really, really pushing to get back into the game and get the equaliser. Genk are more than happy to try and hit them on the break. They then get their goal, their third goal. Tolu Arakadare gets his goal. I'm going to just call him Tolu. I think it might be a little bit easier and quicker for the podcast. But yeah, it's kind of like a couple of passes across the box. Finally find Tolu at the back post. He gets it in just off the post. He looks absolutely delighted. It's great to see. Debut goal for him. Who needs Paul Onuachu? No Paul, no problem for Genk, it seemed. However, literally minutes later, they're back in the game in the sense that Genk get themselves back into the game. Van der Voort comes flying out to catch a cross. He kind of collides with a defender and Lemayek, and he's complaining, Vranken's complaining, but I think he just overcommitted to it. Yeah. I just think he ran into Lamarck. I don't think Lamarck really puts him under any pressure. De Poche then recovers the ball and smashes it home, which sets up a cagey final end to the game. However, Genk do see it out, which means they extend the lead over Club Brugge in fourth to 21 points. And yeah, for Genk, it's frustration because it means they don't capitalise on the Club Brugge Antwerp draw. Also means they've lost 2 on the bounce, which has kind of scuppered the momentum they had going into pushing for that playoff one spot. But it's a good game.
Scott really enjoyed this one, and nice to see Toro Akanare get a goal on his debut.
Yeah, well, that will do his confidence the world of good, and he looks like a very good replacement for Paul Onoachu. I think, you know, to score in your debut, you can't ask for much better than that, to be honest. And poor Joris, this must have been a very nervous watch for him, because like you say, on the whole, Genk looked a little bit out of sorts, I suppose, as you would expect. There'll be a little bit of tinkering and readjusting to losing big Paul. But I thought it's probably a good point to highlight, because we've touched on it kind of on and off a little bit, but what a good season Joseph Pansel and Mike Trezor are having. I mean, just to look at their numbers, Pansel's on 10 goals with 9 assists in 20, and Trezor's got 6 goals and 16 assists in 23. I mean, absolutely sensational numbers from these two. And I think we've forgotten about Ito and Bongonda, because, you know, the new wide men, and they're not so new now, are producing some serious outputs. I mean, Trezor in particular, obviously the assist king by quite some distance on 16. I think I saw some journalists speculating today, actually, that you know, he could be going for upwards of 20 million in the summer, which I thought was interesting. Not sure I entirely agree with that sort of figure, but certainly if he can keep up those numbers, then there will be a lot of interest in him over the summer. But the Genk's offensive output is just fantastic, even without Onoachu. And I know Joris is kind of quite concerned about the departure of Onoachu and the potential impact that might have, and I can kind of understand that. I think the fact that you've got players like Pansel and Trezor on your side with those numbers and that output, that should be somewhat reassuring, I think, if, you know, strikers can, well, the new strikers, the big man Tolo Rokodari, can bed in quickly, and that debut goal will certainly help with that, then I think things will settle down for them just a little bit. So not a bad week on the whole for the Genkies, all things considered. And like you say, no Paul, no problem, eh?
Exactly. Canoes with a new contract till 2027 as well. He came out and said, actually, I love this line, whether it's true or not, whether he commits to it, is like, I've seen other young players go far too early. I don't want to skip steps. I want to kind of get what I can out of this, and then leave through the gates, like kind of head held high, leave through the gates, be like an acceptable departure, which I think is just, it's good to hear. Yeah. And let's hope he does actually honour that, in a sense, because he's a fantastic player. And yeah, we love watching him. Genk, just, he makes them tick through there, with then obviously Tressel and Pansel kind of reaping the rewards of his work in the midfield. So yeah, another good win for Genk. Final game of the weekend saw Zulte Waregem travel to Union, and throughout the week Mbale was talking about how Union are a different level to them, all this sort of stuff, like really heaping praise, which I thought was just standard kind of respecting the opposition, being nice to the opposition. But then I saw his team sheet and I was like, oh no, he clearly does think they're so good there's no point even trying. It was just a strange team sheet, wasn't it, Scott? Like Jelle Vossen on the bench, Ruud Vormer on the bench. I mean, these two then did come on, which makes it even stranger if you're punting the game. No real out and out recognizable striker on the pitch. Like Ramirez started, Alaret started as well. Calafina got his first start actually, which was nice to see, but it was all about the debutant for Union in Jorg Vertessen. That Union could have kind of taken this game for granted, but they just kind of put their foot down and decided, if you're not going to bother, we're going to take you apart, really. Mm. He got an assist for the first goal to Cameron Puertas. Good to see. I'm a big fan of Puertas. I think he's just unlucky that Lazar Armani's been in a good form, and Leenan and Tuma like are such a good three, because I think Puertas is a really, really good player. Lovely finish from him in the 9th minute, much to his delight and the fans' delight. Dante Vanzier was there saying goodbye. He got into the stands. He led the chants, was waving the flags and doing all of that, which kind of just kind of sums up this club, I guess you can say, in terms of that connection between fans and players. And they just, yeah, they've got that momentum going. Vertessen gets his second assist of the game. He just picks up the ball, and I just love the directness of this run. Just drives at the sort of defence. Boniface doing what he does best, kind of peeling off a little bit wide to open up an angle for a pass. Slots it through. Boniface, absolutely no mistake, into the bottom corner. Really good finish from him. Early signs of some good link-up play between those two, which is, yeah, worrying for the rest of the league if they can click quite early on. Vertessen gets taken off, standing ovation, all that jazz. Gustav Nielsen comes on, who's been in good run of form. He gets another one, 4 goals in 4 for him. Must be one of the most informed strikers in Europe at the moment. Just throws his body at the ball to head it into the back of the net. It's just such an awkward but hilariously Gustav Nielsen type of goal. I feel like he's just going to be one of my favourite players in terms of his weirdness, in terms of just some of the goals he scores are just going to be absolutely bizarre. He'll score the scrappy ones, he'll score the odd screamer like he did last week, but this was just a man that looks like he's on the peak of his powers in terms of putting the ball in the back of the net. Then kind of almost an identical one to the Boniface one in terms of just poor midfield ball management by Zoltán Várgem between the defence and the midfield. Teddy Tuma takes advantage. Instead of this time laying off to another strike, he just hits it, smashes it past Sami Bosser, who he gets a hand to it, but he doesn't really have much of a chance because it's just hit with pure power. 4-0 to Union. I know Joris was frustrated when he saw the Zoltán Várgem lineup because it just looked like a complete punt into the long grass, as we said. But for Union, they took advantage of that, obviously. Still haven't lost since they played Genk back in September. They've got Club Bruges next week, and they're going into it with really high levels of confidence. And you've got now, obviously, Boniface is scoring. He's going to start every game as the striker. But then you've got Nielsen and Vertessen that you can mix around. I feel like Vertessen will give them a little bit more than Nielsen can in terms of outside the box and the build-up play, which he showed in this one. But then they can bring on Nielsen to score the goal. So I'm really looking forward to that game next week, Scott, against Club Bruges. I feel like it's going to be a really good test to see. I just have this feeling that Club Bruges will play well in this game. I don't know why. I just have this feeling that we're going to see a really good Club Bruges performance, and then we're going to see a really good Union performance. And now it's going to be a rubbish 0-0. But I don't know. It's one of those games that really does excite me in terms of where these two teams are coming at and the way Union are playing and the way Club need to start playing. It should make for a classic game because, yeah, Union just second geared this, I guess, the whole way.
Yeah, I think that game next weekend is very nicely set up now, as you were saying. There's no doubt about that at all. I completely agree with you. I thought Mbaye Lay's selection and approach to this game was just odd. I mean, if you're fighting for your life and you're in their situation, and they have improved, there has been improvements, you know, since the World Cup finished and we've come back. But to rest two influential players like that, and maybe there's more to it than we're aware of. I don't think there is, because they both came on for the last half hour when you're 2-0 down. So just really, really strange, I thought. I didn't understand that at all. And I don't think it really matters who you're playing against. When you're in their situation, you've just got to play their best side, especially when, you know, it's influential players who are not starting, who would normally. So very, very, very strange stuff there from Mbaye Lay, I thought. Vertessen, really impressive, actually. And it looks like Union have pulled off another fantastic piece of recruitment there. This is a player who's come in, two assists, looks like he's been there for a while, seemed to seamlessly fit in. And Union's recruitment, I know we've sung its praises a lot now. Chris O'Loughlin, the sporting director there, looks to have pulled off another really good bit of business. You know, this is a player who's gone in, as I was saying, an instant impact, if you like. You know, this is a club that has not had that problem of bringing players in and then they've needed a little bit of time to settle. They've been really, really good at bringing in faces that are obviously right for that environment. They do their due diligence, they're clearly good at that. You know, players who are good in their own right, but obviously hungry too, and really exciting from that point of view. And actually, when you look at Union's recruitment more generally, I think there's a really strong argument to say that their recruitment's been the best of all Pro League sides in Belgium now, arguably for the best part of the last couple of years. So there's a lot to be learned from what they do. We've talked about this about on the pod on and off with a number of people, both amongst ourselves and when Alex Musio, the club president, was on as a guest a while ago. And this is just another example of that. And on Nielsen getting his fourth goal, I think that's the first time an Union striker has scored four consecutively as well. That never happened, I don't think, under Van Zier and Undav either. I think both of them got three in occasions, but never quite got to four. So that's an interesting little stat that I'd been watching out for this weekend as well. And he's just doing really well, and they're just flying at the moment. And obviously they've got Europe still to look forward to as well. So I think Scotty Parker will be looking at that game next week, and there will be people on his coaching staff and on the staff at Club who will be probably a little bit concerned kind of coming into this game, because they really need to up their game, or Union are going to be able to do what they couldn't quite do last season, and that is, you know, take something significant off Club, because they are definitely favourites to get the points next weekend.
It's going to be a really good test of Scott Parker's ability to be tactically astute and be able to enforce his own kind of will on the game, because I feel like Union this season, they've been more possession based, but we know that they can play that kind of counter attacking football as well. Like we saw them do it against Club Brugge, where Adinga got sent off pretty early. So they just went into the counter attack and they were still really effective against Hoofkins, and Hoofkins just couldn't really do anything in the second half to change the momentum. It's a good test to see if Scott Parker is adaptable enough to do that. And I just don't feel that there are that many football managers out there at the moment that are that good at being adaptable to that sort of stuff. Whereas it'll be really interesting to see how the teams adapt and stuff. It's like, yeah, it's going to be a fascinating game. Quickly switching over to Dordt Vaar again, we should probably caveat the team selection with their three next games, which are Oostend, Salang and Kortrijk. Like massive games, which is why I think Gano was not even, they just didn't even bother putting him on the bench for this one. Like they're not risking him, get him fit, which I can get behind that. I'd have started Jelle Vossen and Ruud Vormer. I'd have started the players that you can rely on to be fit. But Gano, if he's not 100%, you don't bother playing him against Union. You save him for Oostend.
Yeah. Go and have a massage, mate. Go and have a massage.
Exactly. Exactly. And this run of games, like I don't want to get, okay, probably am getting a little bit ahead of myself, but if this is what I was talking about Leuven earlier, if Dordt Vaar again beat Oostend, Salang and Kortrijk, and Leuven continue on this weird bad run of form, they face each other on the 4th of March after those three games. So Dordt have suddenly grabbed 9 points back of those 11 points they are at the moment. Like for Leuven, it can tighten up very quickly if they don't turn things around. But do we trust Dordt Vaar again to win all three games? Probably not. Let's be honest. Like there's a reason they are where they are, but it just feels like this is where things are going to really, really start to change in these next few games for all these three teams, because they're all going to be looking at these thinking, these are the ones we have to win, which could make for some really poor games of football, but some absolute desperation games of football as well. Like it's going to be fascinating. Like, I feel like these next couple of weeks over at the bottom and the top, like things are really going to start to happen in terms of there's some big games and like big players need to step up to the fore, and like a little bit of kind of teams will be out of things or not out of things and stuff like that. So it's all getting a little bit exciting in February, which is great, because I find February usually the most depressing month of the year because it's just cold and still dark and it's like, right, get on to spring. But at least you got some good Belgian football to keep us going through that part. Those dark nights, I guess. Let's move on from 1A. We were going to talk about Domenico Tedesco if people are listening back and thinking, you haven't spoken about Domenico Tedesco, but that hasn't been confirmed yet and we're not going to jump the gun because there's now been rumours of him being linked to the Hoffenheim job, but fingers crossed that isn't the case because, yeah, Scott's done his deep dive, so they can't mess this up for us after he put the work in. And it's also been, like, when we do get to talk about it, I know there's some fascinating stuff around his interview with the FA that we really want to get into because it is super, super interesting. And we feel like, yeah, we feel like people will be really interested in that when we do get to it. So fingers crossed it'll be him. If not, then you've wasted all that research, Scott. But let's talk about the Challenger Pro League before we get out of here. Give us a lowdown of what's been happening in the second tier.
Yep. Well, we're getting to a very exciting stage there as well, actually. Speaking of exciting games, we're now only one match day away from the playoffs starting in the Challenger. A quick roundup of last weekend's results. Anderlecht under-23s managed to rescue a late 2-2 draw in Brussels against Lommel. Jong Genk managed to throw away a very what was almost a win against Beveren. Beveren dug out a 2-2 draw in the end. Molenbeek won 3-1 at home at the Edmund Maartens in Brussels. Lots of intrigue still going on behind the scenes at Molenbeek at the moment. Will club president Thierry Daly resign? Will he not? Will he stay? A lot of tensions there. Obviously, Julien Gorius, the sporting director, is gone. So they're managing to maintain good form and stay at the top of the table despite the fact that there's a lot of off-the-field politics getting in the way of things there at the moment. Liersa beat Beerschot 1-0, which was a big result for them in terms of the playoff picture. Club Next beat Verton 1-0, which secures their spot, playoff one spot, which they'll be very excited by. And Dender lost 1-0 at home to Denza, who've managed to keep their playoff one hopes alive just. In terms of the playoff one spots, we know there are obviously six places in playoff one. Four of those have now been confirmed and guaranteed. So we know that Molenbeek, Beveren, Beerschot and Club Next will be four of the six sides. There are two places up for grabs still, which are obviously going to go to the wire with next weekend's results. So in terms of games to watch out for next weekend, probably the big one is Lommel's home game against Lierse. Both of those sides still need points to secure their place. Lommel really need to win that game, I think. Lierse don't need to win it, but I think might have to secure their spot. So it's going to get rather exciting to see who gets those last two places, I think. And obviously, we were lucky enough to be at the reverse fixture in October between Lierse and Lommel. So we've had a close look at both of these sides and we'll be expecting them to go hard at one another this weekend. So that's an exciting one to kind of keep an eye on and get along to if you can, actually, because there's quite a lot at stake there for both sides. In terms of the goal scoring charts, Beveren's Tierno Barry is still top. He's got 14 and 21 now, and just behind him is Anderlecht's Lucas Stasen, who's got 13 and 19. And does anybody know who is top of the assist chart in the Challenger Pro League? Anyone? Yes, it's Lierse's Guillaume Scriver, who has 8 in 20, which isn't bad at all. And they could do with him providing another couple this weekend.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that reverse fixture was great because Lommel were good to start, and then that storm hit, and suddenly everything changed. I thought you were going to also mention who's top of the yellow card list, and it's Joachim van Dam, which will come to very little surprise to anyone who's followed Belgian football for a while that Joachim van Dam is leading that one. I wonder how many fines he's having to pay for that. Also, if you haven't seen it, definitely check out Molenbeek's first goal from Alexis de Saat. Obviously, a player we've seen a lot in the Pro League. Now, obviously, down there on loan. I think it is on loan still from Antwerp. Really, really nice finish from outside the box from de Saat. And yeah, it's interesting, like you said, Scott, that Molenbeek, despite everything that's going on off the pitch, have just been on a scintillating run of form. And it's funny because so many times people talk about the off-field stuff impacting on the field stuff, but lots of footballers always say they just try and ignore it all, and it's clear that Molenbeek have. But then another player actually you mentioned as well, Lucas Stasen. I saw Brian Ream was like, yeah, well, we haven't brought in many strikers, so it's good because we're going to give the boys like Lucas Stasen a chance. And obviously Anderlecht fans are like, great, more Lucas Stasen. And then it's the next day, yeah, Lucas Stassen's not really available for selection because he doesn't do what we want him to do. It's like, which one, what did he do during training? Like, do you know what I mean? In the space of 12 hours, he was suddenly gone from he's going to get more chances to not. And it's like, the kid scored 13 goals in the Challenger League. You don't have any strikers at the time. I get it, but I'm also like, it just feels very short-sighted in the sense of, I know you want him to do a certain thing and do what you want him to do, but if that's not his profile of player, he can't necessarily do that. But is it worth losing someone like that who's ridiculously talented, clearly, for the sake of, like, do you know what I mean? Like, Brian Riemer may not, like, obviously, I don't want Brian Riemer to be sacked, and I'm not saying that should happen, but if Brian Riemer left in the summer and someone comes in that suits Stassen's style of play, but because Riemer didn't like him or he didn't suit Riemer's style of play, you've now lost him. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's
a really interesting one, actually, because he started more games and scored more goals than Slimani has. And I know that's a bit of an unfair comparison, but when you look at the fact they're struggling to score at the moment and they're looking for, you know, for strikers who can maybe do the business, it was encouraging to hear that they were going to include him in the A squad and have a closer look at him and maybe give him a little run just to kind of see, only 24 hours or so later, to go, do you know what, actually, his data's a bit dodgy. And I don't even think the argument that, yeah, but you can't compare player, you know, the Pro League to the Challenger Pro League and the difference in level, to me it almost doesn't matter. You know, here's a young player who has pace, trickery, and he scored 13 and 19, and at any level that's got to get sent somebody's attention. So it is a slightly strange one, but then I suppose lots of strange things have been happening at Anderlecht recently, so, you know, at least that's consistent.
yeah, it kind of just fits the bill. But yeah, I know the fans were frustrated, but it was nice to see Jesper Fredberg come out and like answer some questions about the transfer window. Really interesting. They obviously wanted Tolu Akadare as well, and then Genk came in and took him, although there's differing stories about what happened.
There was an agent, actually. I say agent, actually, you know, he might not actually have been an agent, he may have been a go-between in this case, who did come out and say that the reason he actually ended up at Genk was because Anderlecht refused to deal with this particular intermediary, and that's where the deal fell down. And there was also a counter accusation as well that I think Genk used used apparently the results of an Anderlecht medical as part of their signing process, which you're not actually allowed to do. And I thought, I'm not sure that's true or not. But yeah, there was a little bit of mudslinging going on in that one, which is tells me more that both clubs really wanted him, actually.
Yeah, I can kind of see why. And then they also were going to go for Harry Tofolo.
Mm.
Apparently they have email proof that Nottingham Forest agreed to the deal, but then Forest got an injury to one of their fullbacks, so pulled out, which now is bringing up stories, I think, is of the 1984 European semi-final, where Anderlecht bribed a referee or something, like a Forest-Anderlecht game where Forest lost because the referee was bribed, so... A lot of Forest fans have come out and been like, well, serves you right.
Ancient history, yeah.
So it's all very interesting. And Anderlecht and drama always go hand in hand, and we just get to kind of enjoy it while the poor Anderlecht fans have to suffer it and hope for the best, I guess. But anyway, I think that probably is where we will leave it this week, because I think next week we're going to have so much to talk about. Scott, as always, it's been a pleasure sitting down with you to chat Belgian football.
An absolute delight to join you, Ben. And I'm off now to have some wasabi.
Oh, I could actually do some wasabi. If you'll enjoy the podcast and what we did, please do leave us a review on your podcast app of choice. You can also get in touch with us on various on our social medias, mainly Twitter is where we'll interact most. If you've got any questions you'd like us to answer during a podcast episode, please do let us know. We know people do get in touch with questions. We usually just answer them on Twitter, but if you'd like us to actually speak in more depth about it on the actual recording, then we're more than happy to do so. But as per usual, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Belgian Football Podcast, and we'll speak to you next week.